Good morning. May it please the court. Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Ernest Richardson. Reversal is required in this credibility case because the trial court defied two well-established legal principles. The first is that which prohibits the use of one witness from vouching for the credibility of another, and that which requires the trial court to issue a limiting instruction when evidence is admitted and can be used for both a proper and improper purpose and a party requests the instruction. In this case, there were two complainants who made statements to the Child Advocacy Center. Pursuant to 3507, the state used the interviewer, Ms. Polly, to introduce those statements. However, she was permitted to talk about her qualifications, the techniques she used in obtaining the statements, and give an opinion about the disclosure process. With respect to her qualifications, she told the jury that she was retired as a police officer lieutenant after 26 years, and that she had been trained to interview children who had been sexually abused and trained not to use leading questions. She also discussed the RADC protocol, which is the rapport, anatomy, touch, abuse scenario, which she said is where they talk about what definitely has happened, and closure, which is where they reinforce the child that they have done nothing wrong. She also talked about other precautions that are taken to ensure these statements are trustworthy. Specifically, police don't go into detail with these children before they're interviewed by a Child Advocacy Center because they don't want them to be over-interviewed. And she says, we all know if somebody tells the story way too many times, it changes in its content. Later on,
your position is, of this list, is everything on this list should be inadmissible?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I believe the state argues that the qualifications and techniques were admissible, and that the opinion that she ultimately made, which was, I think as far as truthfulness, I think it's very apparent when you talk with a child and go through that, I think it's very obvious when they are being truthful. The state has conceded at oral argument that this was error. However, it argued that it came about in a confused manner and therefore cannot be plain error. That's simply incorrect. As the state also indicated during oral argument.
Well, before you develop that, let me just make sure I have in mind what actually happened here.
Yes.
There was an objection made before this witness gave her direct testimony.
That's correct.
And it was a non-specific objection, and the judge's response to that was to keep the written CV of this witness out of evidence.
Yes.
But nonetheless allowed her to proceed and talk about her qualifications and then to go further and talk about the techniques that are used to elicit answers from children.
Yes.
And there was no objection, no second objection to that.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct. There was no follow-up objection.
There was no motion to strike that portion of the testimony?
No, unfortunately, there was not. But what the basis of the objection to the curriculum vitae is very clear what the basis was. Defense counsel said, quote, the jury can make their own determination on credibility and everything else. Ms. Polly really isn't offering an opinion. I think this bolsters the other witnesses.
Okay, but your position, and tell me if I have it right or not, is number one that the trial judge sua sponte should have cut off any discussion by this witness of interrogation techniques and, you know, her own credentials.
Right.
And number two, that the only testimony that the witness should have been allowed to give was just the bare testimony authenticating the 3507 statement.
That's correct.
Period.
Yes. And what I cite to for purposes of the issue being preserved is Sears versus MidCap and Wheat versus State. In both of those cases, the attorney objected generally. And for example, in Sears, they objected to the pattern instructions being used. The court found that preserved a specific objection to the adverse inference instruction. And more specifically, in Wheat versus State, which involved a child sex case, The court said that the general objection to the voir dire of an expert was sufficient to preserve the objection to her specific testimony as to the probabilities and statistics of children telling the truth.
Let me interrupt for a minute. I have clear recollection, although I couldn't tell you the names of the cases, but I have clear recollection of more than one case involving CAC interviews where the RATAC procedure, if that's what you want to call it, is described to the jury. And although I don't recall cases where the counselor said, you know, and I can tell when they're telling the truth, you know, that's another issue. But in terms of describing the process and how the child is interviewed and all that, that's been done a lot of times.
That's correct.
And if I understand you, you're saying that we should put an end to that.
Yes.
And do it on a plain error. I realize you're arguing that it's been sufficiently raised below,
right.
but if necessary, we should do it as a matter of plain error if we have to use that standard. And just to kind of see where this goes, 3507 statements either tend to come in through a CAC counselor or a police officer.
Right.
And when they come in through a police officer, everybody's told it's a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And that also carries with it some sense of, oh, well, you know, this person took this interview, there must be some credibility to the answers he got.
Right.
But we don't say you can't identify the person as a police officer. All we've said is, you know, we can't allow the questions that the officer used if they are questions that suggest facts or a sense of belief in the witness's statement. So what I'm asking you is, are you asking the court to basically shut down as much as possible all evidence, all testimony from the person who's providing a 3507 statement?
I'm asking the court to require the state or any sponsoring witness to comply with this court's narrow interpretation of 3507. There's a couple of responses. When dealing with the police officer, we're not objecting to the CAC person being identified as the CAC person. What we're saying is all that's required, and Mr. Wallace was correct previously when he said there needs to be some context, and that's correct. The person should get on the stand and say, I'm Ms. Polly. I work for the Child Advocacy Center. What usually happens is when children make complaints, the police refer them to me. On such and such a date, so-and-so came to see me, and I asked her questions, I've reviewed the tape, and this is her statement. Police don't get up there and testify as to the techniques they use and how much experience they have being a police officer, and nor should they. And what this court has said in Keyes, Hatcher, Johnson, and Ray is that all that's required for a proper foundation is to ask on direct exam of the declarant about the event, the statement, the voluntariness of the statement, and the truthfulness of the statement. There was no issue with respect to voluntariness of the witness in which this statement was entered into, introduced into. And the state says, well, later there was some problem with Linda's. There was an objection to that. However, what Hatcher says is that to determine voluntariness, the prosecutor, whoever the sponsoring witness is, party is, asks the declarant on direct exam, is this voluntary? They say yes, they're done. They deny it, then a voir dire is held outside the presence of the jury. It's not for the state to go into detail after detail in front of the jury and take it upon itself to say, this is all necessary for voluntariness. Further, the questions involving the disclosure process came after the tape was played, Brenda's tape was played. And in fact, I believe the state even said during our original oral argument that the question about disclosure that came after the tape, that it was asked after the tape and, quote, went not at all to the particular witness or the foundation. And that was my reading of the transcripts, page 26 to 27. And so he's acknowledged that the question about the disclosure process, where she was essentially asking, do kids tell you everything up front? And the answer, according to Mr. Wallace, was to be no, and that was the end of it. Okay, well, that's already erroneous and incorrect. So let's assume that. We go into it, and according to Mr. Wallace, the answer was confusing. The court will note in the appendix that the answer went on for about four or five sentences. She was never cut off. She said something about truthfulness, and the prosecutor said, you were a little confusing. When you said truthfulness, you meant, then the CAC person went in and said, I think I misstated that, and then gave the ultimate opinion as, I think you can tell when someone's being truthful. Again, she was not cut off by the prosecutor. The prosecutor said, okay, that's not really what I was asking. All right, she was asking that whether the children had actually disclosed up front. Justice Ridgely asked Mr. Wallace, well, even that answer, it suggests, doesn't it, that this is a process that elicits the whole truth? Mr. Wallace?
You've seen a movie some of us haven't seen.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, there were transcripts that were filed on the record, I believe, that were ordered by the court, I believe, of the first argument.
Okay. I guess I didn't make it to the theater.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Mr. Wallace responded to Justice Ridgely's question, that's designed to attempt to do that, yes, Your Honor, and then try to explain the mitigating factors of it.
Before you go further into the specifics of this case, let me just back up one step. In response to Justice Berger's question, you described a very narrowly tailored direct exam of the CD's child advocacy witness. All that, the minimum that would be required to authenticate the 3507 statement.
Yes.
Does that view of what the law should be also apply to a police officer being used as an authenticating witness?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so there should be no distinction between
that's those. Correct. And in fact, for some reason, it appears in most cases that that's the way they do it with police officers. Justice Berger, you are correct that in case after case they have done the erratic portion of the testimony that was put in here. Also, with respect to plain error, I just want to point out that
before you get to that,
yes, Your Honor.
If let's assume that the state puts on this minimalist direct, what can a defendant do through cross-examination that would open the door to a redirect that brings out the information short of vouching for truthfulness as to the witness's background?
Absolutely, that could happen. And I think it does happen a lot of cases with police officers. Basically, he would probably question something to the effect of, well, you know, you were suggesting things to her. You were being so friendly with this person, showing him these body parts, drawing pictures of the family, et cetera, weren't you? And then I think that's when it would be reasonable for the prosecutor to come back and have the sponsoring witness say, this is why I did that. I, you know, I've trained to do it this way.
Just as a matter of what the practice is, and I think we may have gone over this before, but for everybody's benefit, is what occurred here typical of how authenticating witness testimony is treated in 3507 cases, or is this an outlier?
It's closer to what's normally done with respect to child advocacy center cases. As Justice Berger pointed out, there are police officer cases, and those, most of the time that I've seen, the police officer gets up there and says, yeah, I took this person's statement on such and such a date, and that's it. Child advocacy center cases, I will acknowledge that a lot of times they do go into erratic, and sometimes they do give a background of their qualifications. They certainly do not go into an opinion as to truthfulness, and the prosecutor certainly not after the tape has been played, sua sponte, ask about the disclosure process, asking them for an opinion as to why this process would be best able to tell the truth.
Does the age of the complaining witnesses in this case make any difference?
I don't believe so, no, Your Honor.
There shouldn't be a different contextual examination if the child is 4 or 5 years old as opposed to 15 for purposes of effective cross-examination?
No, there should not be. I think what In their brief, the state has said, well, this court has said in other child sex cases that more foundation is required. I think what this court has said with respect to the factors that are necessary, if there is some vagary by the child, for example, with respect to he did something nasty to me versus specifically saying what happened, this court has kind of, you know, given the child the benefit of the doubt, for lack of a better way of saying that. It has not said they get to dump in an entire speech on their training and experience and why we ask questions this way. The jury will get to see the tape. The jury gets to make those credibility decisions. And that's exactly what should happen here.
So your point is 3507 is a limited statute with specific requirements, and the prerequisites for introducing a 3507 statement are limited and don't really include the background credentials or anything of the witness who's relating the statement.
That's correct.
Once you put in enough to give context, as you described it earlier in your argument, the focus of 3507 is on the statement.
Correct.
And the rest of the trial should be about the evidence that comes out of the witness stand.
That's correct. And I think also in this case, what's interesting is, contrary to the argument on appeal that this was for voluntariness, during her opening statement, the prosecutor says, talking about Ms. Polly, she's trained how to interview children, not just sex abuse, but just children witnesses, trained how to ask non-leading questions, in other words, to let the children answer, clearly indicating the point of introducing all this was to establish the credibility of the child. Also,
Let me interrupt again. As I recall, the prosecutor's concern, and it seemed that it was honest and not contrived, was that the children, when they took the stand, were not going to come off really well in the sense that they were going to be quiet and a flat affect, and perhaps the jury would get the impression that they're being forced to say these things and that, you know, maybe they should discount what they're hearing. So the CAC person was being asked the questions that she was asked to try and explain why a child might talk in this fashion. You agree that that's basically what was presented to the court, and I'm not really concerned right now with what the court's response was. I'm more concerned with moving forward. Is there any place for anyone to provide testimony at a criminal trial about the way witnesses who are trying to talk about an issue like this sometimes sound?
Yes. In Wheat versus State, this court talked about a situation where an individual was presented to talk about the fact that children who make sure it's not Powell that I'm talking about. Was testified as an expert in interfamily sex abuse to try to explain some background, give some expertise about this in order to help with respect to the witness. This court said that wasn't proper in that case. And this court set some parameters and said, if there are specific reasons to this case as to why the person was delayed in reporting or what have you, then it may be possible that an expert is possible, but not general facts of stress, etc. And that dealt with an expert. Here, Ms. Polly was never declared an expert, first of all, nor was the jury ever told what the purpose of her testimony was. And to explain the demeanor, it kind of goes into the second argument a little bit, but it is proper on some occasions for the prosecutor to ask questions to try to explain demeanor. But first of all, it should be put on the record prior to asking questions. And then the jury must be given an instruction that that's what it's for. And that was not done here at all.
Well, I guess the question is, in those cases where there may be a legitimate reason for the prosecutor to ask questions that go beyond the minimum required for authentication, is that supposed to surface and be dealt with in some sort of in limine practice, or at least in a proceeding where the jury is out of the courtroom?
Jury's out of the courtroom. For example, if as the prosecutor is questioning the person and they see that they're, you know, dead affect, they approach the judge and say, look, Your Honor, I feel like we need to explain why the demeanor is as it is, get the court to agree or not agree, and then, counter to what happened in this case, grant the defense motion for a limiting instruction on that as to what the purpose is.
But aren't we really talking about two related but separate issues? This case is a 3507 case, and in Wheaton Powell, we talked about a witness who was qualified as an expert,
right,
and qualified to give an opinion that in these type of cases, it's not unusual to recant, because juries wouldn't understand that children recant.
Right.
And to go back to Justice Berger's question, as I understand your answer, in another case that doesn't have to do with 3507, it's possible the state would be able to come forward with an expert who would be qualified as an expert and give an opinion about something that was relevant to that case, just as recantation was relevant in the other cases.
That's absolutely correct.
But it would be, as I said, a separate issue about expert testimony on something that related to a specific fact in that case,
right,
other than the introduction of the 3507 statement.
Right, and apparently the prosecutor had not identified that as something that, or at least identified that for the parties or the court, that was going to be necessary to have these techniques gone into. As I said, she mentioned it in opening, and in fact, the state, again, in its oral argument, said that the prosecutor realized that the answer she got from these questions was unresponsive. However, I would say they were already in the wrong territory to begin with. And she also would have been a proper to join in a motion had defense counsel asked for limiting instruction, but she didn't, and that begs the question. The prosecutor knew the answer was unresponsive, and would have been proper to join in a motion for a curative instruction. Why didn't that happen, notwithstanding defense counsel's failure?
We'll save the balance of your time.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. Paul Wallace on behalf of the state. Although you already knew I was arguing this, because obviously my argument last time was the feature of the first argument today.
Can I start with a simple question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the state have any problem with the idea of saying that for 3507 statements, whoever is called as the witness to present or authenticate the 3507 statement says nothing more than my name is Joe Smith, I'm a CAC counselor, I took this statement from this child on such and such a date?
I obviously if the court rules that way, we won't, but
why would you have a problem with that kind of limited approach?
Only to the Raddick type interview. The jury sits there and watches an interview that is probably so much different than anything they've ever seen before, because it starts off really where there's a discussion about nothing but the kid's family and things like that, and it goes through certain aspects of that. The state does have a concern that the jury would not understand necessarily the context under which this child is brought in and comes before a person and is questioned or spoken to in that way.
Well, all right. My concern is this. Generally, you don't bring in experts of any kind unless whatever the subject is one that a common person of ordinary intelligence couldn't fully understand without the help of the expert, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I can't imagine a jury that would have trouble understanding a process that they're going to see where a small child comes in and is in a strange environment, and the person who's going to conduct the interview is friendly and relaxed and, you know, plays with dolls or whatever they do. Why is that something that has to be explained?
The other aspect of it, Your Honor, is that it does go to the reliability of the statement itself and understanding the situation in which the child is brought there. Two of the foundations that the court has laid for 3507, and we can say, well, it's a very simple foundation. You just need to get them to say voluntary, or somebody to get to say it was voluntarily done. This does go to voluntariness. Why is this child here, and how did we go about asking them these questions?
Well, as I understood Ms. Walker's position as to what could be asked, I am Ms. Polly. When children make complaints to the police, they are brought here, and I conduct interviews at the Child Advocacy Center. Doesn't that explain the process for why the child is suddenly at this location?
It does, Your Honor. But the process, as I said, I believe the process is so different when you look at it, that the jury may not understand the circumstances under which this person is interviewing them or why they're interviewing them in the way that they are. Certainly, if you have a child, and let's assume that the defense is not going to question the reliability of the statement, sure, that's going to happen. They question the reliability of every one of these statements. In fact, they did it here. The defense, and to lay out how this happened, Ms. Walker is incorrect. At A22, the prosecutor specifically said to the judge and defense counsel before this witness took the stand, here is what I intend to do. I intend to call Ms. Poley, it's Poley, it's P-O-L-E-Y, I don't know why it's wrong in the transcript, so I apologize, I'm probably going to call her Poley, and everybody else will say Polly. Ms. Poley is going to take the stand. She's going to explain how she questioned him, including the Raddick technique, and laid the rest of it, then we're going to take the witness off, and things like that. The judge turns to Mr. Wilkinson and says, that would be the appropriate protocol. You agree, Mr. Wilkinson? And he says, yes, Your Honor. They had no problem with the laying the foundation in that way.
Let me stop you here. Does the state have any problem with, as a protocol, requiring the prosecutor to tell the court and opposing counsel, defense counsel, outside the presence of the jury, precisely what testimony will be elicited from the authenticating witness?
No. If it's something more...
If it goes beyond the bare minimum required to authenticate...
The state would absolutely be in agreement that if the rule was, we should do the bare minimum. I'm this person, I take the statement here, I do it under those circumstances. We should look to minimize that as much as possible so that there is more...
That should be a default rule. Huh?
Yes.
All right. And then if the state...
If there's a need...
If there's a reason to go beyond the testimony that would be more than the default rule, then there would be some procedure taking place outside the presence of the jury where everybody would be told what's going to happen next.
Yes. And why? The sponsoring side should say... we need to explain the Raddick technique because we know that they're going to argue about the reliability and the fact that the interviewer didn't follow it here, which they did.
Right, and your argument is that's what happened here. There was no objection, and therefore we should be hard put to find that there was error, if there was error,
yes.
It wasn't plain.
It certainly wasn't plain. I will say at A22. There wasn't the, here is why we are explaining Raddick technique. I believe that it had become such a regular practice that everybody understood that's what would happen with the CAC interviewer. And so there wasn't that extra step that the court's talking about now, and that is, if you're going to go away and say, I need to explain this technique, or I need to explain how this child came here, because, for instance, in the later witness, they wanted to argue about her voluntariness, or reliability.
You say it's clearly not plain error. But we had decided a lot of 3507 cases that say you put in the witness's statement. And we had decided a lot of cases that talk about redacting things that weren't the witness's statement. So it's pretty clear in the context of 3507 where our jurisprudence is you put in the minimum basis to introduce the 3507 statement. Then you put in the 3507 statement, and to the extent there's extraneous things, you redact it. Now, given that background to our general 3507 statement, this really looks different than the 3507 statements that come in generally, doesn't it?
Not so, Your Honor. I don't believe it does. Because we never really talk, there's really not much discussion in those. I'd suggest respectfully the foundation has continued to grow over the years, over 3507. There hasn't been much discussion about what are the questions you actually ask to lay those foundations. And for instance, when we talk about voluntariness, it's clear that it may be done through the declarant, him or herself, or on voir dire, and that may also be come in front of the jury, mainly because voluntariness is a question that goes to the reliability of the statement made itself, depending on the circumstances.
But you're saying that it's consistent with 3507 to introduce the CV of the interviewer to demonstrate the voluntariness of the statement?
Not necessarily the CV, and the state has no issue with the fact that the judge felt that to be cumulative of the basic background of it. But there was a discussion earlier about, well, police officers get up and say, well, I'm Joe Police Officer, and here's the tape of the interview I did. The reality is that when you look in those transcripts, you'll see police officer was normally called much earlier in the case, and that's where we did the background of them. And who are you? What agency do you work for? How long you been a detective? And those types of things that we might do. And so when they're actually brought up for 3507 Foundation,
they put up. What we're looking for here is for you to connect and tell us what you want to do to the way 3507 should work.
Well, I think,
you know, the fact that you can have a police officer testify early in the trial about his background for a legitimate purpose, it doesn't mean if that had never happened and they were only called for the 3507 statement, you could do it there.
That's true, Your Honor. But I think that I look to, for instance, the case of Hignett, where the court talked about, witness background and asking, some basic background foundational questions of witnesses, because otherwise you're throwing a human being up there and the jury's like, who is this person and why do I listen to them? Why do I understand what they're doing? So I suggest that there can be some minimal background of them. In a CAC interviewer circumstance, that normally is their first introduction into the case for the jury to understand who they are and what they're doing there. And I suggest that asking them basically, you're a CAC interviewer, what does that entail, how long have you been doing it? I think the problem ends up, and the problem that we're all grappling with here is when they get into more of the discussing the technique and whether or not that is in some way lending credibility or reliability to the statement that you might not otherwise be able to do.
When you say technique, you mean the technique of eliciting answers from a child?
The technique used to interview. And that technique may, different techniques may end up in different circumstances. I know that Justice Ridgely in the last argument had asked about police officers discussing their technique. So I do agree that if the default rule is minimize, introduce who the person is with a minimal amount of fanfare so that we don't get too far afield, and only go into those other questions about, for instance, why did you question in this way? Why did you use this technique? If it's necessary for the purposes of that case. It may be necessary.
But only after the defense counsel and the court have been notified of that intention in advance outside the presence of the jury, and counsel has an opportunity to object and the court has an opportunity to rule.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
At the risk of causing great angst among my colleagues, I'd like to refocus the discussion for a moment, move away from 3507. And get back to what I thought was the initial argument made by your opposing colleague, and that is whether or not the manner in which the CAC or the CAC interviewer was presented constituted vouching for the credibility of the child witnesses. I'm concerned about a circumstance where the judge says you can't testify as an expert, therefore you can't give an opinion, and we won't let the jury see the qualifications in a CV that would lead them to infer that you're an expert. That's out. However, as this person testifies, she's allowed to go into virtually everything that's on the CV orally in front of the jury. She's allowed to say things like, in this technique, this is where we get into definitely what has happened. She talks about how she has the ability to ensure the trustworthiness of a complainant's statement, and that flows from not over-interviewing the child and not asking suggestive or leading questions. How is that not vouching for the credibility of the witnesses who are going to be in a tape that the jury's going to see and could assess readily without an opinion from this witness on those critical issues of the credibility of 15-year-old girls?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that what it's not vouching for the credibility of that individual witness. What it is doing is saying these statements come about from a reliable manner. It's done in a reliable manner. Just as if, for instance, if we, you know, sweated these kids for 3 days and gave them no food and then brought them in, certainly the defense would want to know that.
Our technique allows us, I as an expert am telling you, that our technique allows us to tell what definitely has happened, and that our technique ensures the trustworthiness of the children's statements. Now, this is a person that the judge has said, you can't introduce their CV. It sends a signal, it seems to me, that the person can't offer opinions as an expert. Yet, as the person testifies, they do exactly that. And not only is it some generalized opinion, it goes to the heart of the whole issue, the credibility of the witnesses who are the complainants in the case. How does that happen?
Your Honor, I believe I view it differently than the court does, and the state views it differently than the court does, that this was not the witness giving an opinion that these people are telling the truth. What it's saying is, here's how this statement came about, and it's done that way to try and ensure the most reliable statement we can get.
How does it fit into the vouching cases? We have several vouching cases. I didn't hear anyone discuss anything about vouching other than introduce the topic, and that's why I tried to move a bit from the techniques under 3507 to the critical issue here of the extent to which the CAC interviewer, by describing the protocols and the techniques, suggested to the jury that they will produce the truth because of the way in which we conduct the interview. You can rely on these answers. That's the clear inference from what she said.
Your Honor, I suggest that that's one view of it. I don't believe that that's what she was saying. I think what it's doing is setting the context for the jury to understand how and why the children are questioned in the way that they are. Now, I do believe, and I agree that after the statement was given, that's where I think you get into the vouching area, and that's where the CAC interview misstepped. Answered a question in a way that nobody expected, and that's why the prosecutor kind of did shut her down and said, that's not what I'm asking you. Interestingly, there was no objection to that. And interestingly, there was no objection at all to explaining the Radek technique. In fact, counsel said, I don't have a problem with that. And when asked about, when he said, I don't want the CV to come in, and the judge said, I am going to allow her to testify about her background, he said, fine. And then cross-examined about the technique, saying, you say you don't lead. You put these ideas in her head, didn't you? I mean, it was clear that they made a strategic decision to say, let her get up there and explain her technique, because I'm going to try and blow her out of the water on her technique, that she didn't follow it, and in fact put ideas in these kids' heads. He does cross-examine her on that very thing. So, and now wants to say, well, it didn't work, so let's say it's plain error that they got to do that to begin with. Didn't object to that, to the use of the technique. Didn't object to the use of her background. In fact, tried to use it to their advantage. Again, I agree with Justice Jacobs that probably the best way to go through this would be exactly what the justice has outlined.
Solve my fundamental problem, which is a trial judge who says you can't introduce the CV because that will suggest to the jury, in effect, that this person is an expert, but then allows that expert to give opinions. Why is that not troublesome?
Well,
other than the fact that the defense didn't object to it.
I don't know that the judge, because I believe the judge wasn't saying not because she's an expert. What she specifically said is the document itself, the CV, is not necessary. I'll exclude it. To me, that appears to be much more of a cumulative evidence ruling than a it's improper to have her discuss what her background is, because she specifically says, I'll allow questions about the witness's background and experience to support her training as a forensic evaluator. The CV is out. The document itself, the CV, is not necessary. I'll exclude it. That's at 833. Again, that sounds much more like a cumulative evidence ruling. And that's how I have always read it.
Your position is it doesn't touch the heart of the issue, which is whether she's an expert or not, just that it would be cumulative if I'm going to go ahead and let her testify to everything that's in it anyway.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with her being able to testify to everything that's in the CV or near everything in the course of explaining her protocol.
Yes.
Okay.
The state's suggestion here is that while we may say, as we have many times in 3507, we need to recalibrate the way we do foundation, this certainly was not plain error. And the claim of plain error came out of the blue, quite honestly, to everybody here, given the trial record, and the fact is the court noticed itself. This has been the way these interviews have come in for quite a while.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but would this, in your view, be a different case if we were talking about a 3-, 4-, or 5-year-old girl as opposed to a 2-, 15-year-old girls? Would that make a difference in the latitude that the CAC interviewer would have in describing the process and children's reactions and their likelihood of their statements being trustworthy and the ability to definitely know what's happened?
I believe it would, and I believe that in those circumstances, the best path forward is to do exactly what Justice Jacobs said, and that is the prosecutor would have to explain why we need that greater foundation, that greater explanation. Because I suggested an explanation of, for instance, the technique or how the child came about there does go to some of the very foundational questions that this court has posed, and that is, for instance, voluntariness. But also, the court has said we have to ask the child, did you tell the truth about the events? And implicitly, is this statement have truthful statements in it? And as the court has always said, different foundational aspects can be met by different witnesses. It doesn't just have to be the declarant, because sometimes the declarant either can't or won't tell you. For instance, you know, the gone south witness will say, I didn't talk to him voluntarily, and then we bring the police officer in to explain that.
If the complaining witness who gives the 3507 statement is on the stand and is asked, was what you said in that statement the truth? And the answer, yes. Would there ever be any need for a CAC interviewer to say that my techniques allow me to know definitely what happened, and to ensure the trustworthiness, we make sure we don't ask any suggestive or leading questions? Would that be irrelevant to the truthfulness of the statement if the declarant says, I told the truth?
I believe it would, yes.
Then why would the CAC interviewer be able to make that statement before the jury sees the statement, or before the jury hears the declarant say it's the truth? How is it anything but vouching under those circumstances?
I would not suggest that it is vouching in and of itself. What it is instead is an explanation as to, here's why this is a reliable statement, here's how it came about. And perhaps it would be less relevant if the witness himself said yes, but it doesn't make it cumulative vouching or anything else. What it's saying is there's two pieces of evidence that tell you that you can rely on this statement. One, the witness himself saying it's the truth, and two, an explanation with it, for instance, if it's a very young witness, of saying, here's how we question him to ensure that we try to avoid the pitfalls.
Well,
of
in a typical trial, though, counsel for either side can't call a witness up and say, that witness told the truth. The one that testified just before me, or the one that's going to testify right after me, I assure you they're telling the truth. That's just unacceptable.
But what they can do...
Why is this different?
They may not be able to come out and say, they told the truth. But for instance, let's say you had a police situation where the person says, yeah, they beat it out of me. You can bring in that witness to say, the police officer say, no, he volunteered everything he said, and he told us, voluntarily, he had no problem, and we were able to actually confirm a couple of the things he said by physical evidence or whatever. So you can, in fact, show the reliability of a witness's statement or testimony. You just can't have a witness coming in saying, they told the truth. And that's what this is. This is saying, these are the circumstances under which this statement is made, and therefore there is reliability to it. It's just in a different form than we may otherwise confirm the veracity of a witness's statement.
Well, could someone, if you used the word reliability, could the word truth be substituted for reliability? There's truth to it? Where do we draw the line there? Does reliability mean truth, or does it mean something else?
Well, I'm not saying that the witness could get up and say, this statement is reliable, or this statement is truthful. But what they can do is explain the circumstances under which the statement came about so that the jury can determine that themselves. And that's what they're doing in these circumstances, saying, okay, here's how we give the interview.
Is there a time parameter to that, though? Why is the training that may have happened years earlier, why does that tie in?
Well, to ensure that when the jury has to make a determination as to whether or not the statement's made and it's reliable, all of the circumstances under which it's made. Is this somebody, I mean, if you know, we brought in the guy who, you know, is changing our oil to try and apply this technique, there's probably a much greater different question about whether or not it's reliable.
Well, let's suppose that the witness whose 3507 statement it is on the stand, and they said, the statement was voluntary and it's truthful. Then the 3507 statement comes in a pristine way. Could the state call another witness and say, and here's why you should think it's truthful and voluntary? Or would that be the end?
To directly come in and talk about the statement itself and say, this is why you should believe it is reliable, or it is truthful?
Well, given the fact that the witness has said it's truthful, and the witness has said it's voluntary, and then the statement comes in, what can the state do after that? In our case, you know, could this witness have been called to talk about the statement?
I believe for the minimal purposes of introducing it and explaining how that statement came about, yes. I just think that otherwise you're leaving the jury with a huge void.
Your answer is going to be helpful to the court. And so let me make sure my question is clear. The witness says, I made the statement, it was voluntary, and it was truthful. And then the person who's introducing the statement gives the minimum background, I took the statement. And then the statement comes in. After that, what, if any, elaboration can there be?
I suggest that we would go to Justice Jacobs' construct then, and that is there would be no other elaboration unless there's need in this specific case. Let's say the defense then starts to attack the reliability of the statement, then we may bring in the interviewer to say, wait a minute, here's how that happens. You know, here's why you can do it. And I that's why I suggest that probably that default procedure is the best
that
way to
be,
avoid these pitfalls.
But that might be proper rebuttal. But in the case of the state's case in chief, why should the state be entitled to buttress in that way the testimony of the child declarant that the statement is voluntary and truthful?
Well,
until there's some attack on that statement.
And I see that my time is up, but I know the court would want me to answer the question. If we're talking about a procedure moving forward, then obviously it wouldn't happen beforehand. But in that conversation, let's assume the defense says, oh, we're attacking the reliability of the statement. We think that she led him and everything else. Then it obviously, time-wise, we would do it when we first introduced the statement and we had the expert or the interviewer up there.
Or at least she would try to, and then the judge can.
I would certainly make that application if somebody like Mr. Wilkinson said, I'm going to have at her. I would ask to do it then. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I want to address the Chief Justice's concern about vouching straightforward. There's two cases, Capano and Graves, which deals with the fact that another witness was used inappropriately to try to address the techniques and the reliability of the statements. For example, in Graves versus State, the state brought in a defense attorney to testify that two witnesses had come to him, and he said, you need to cooperate fully with the state. And ladies and gentlemen, they told the state the same thing they told me. And by the way, I'm this great defense attorney in the state of Delaware. And the court said the net effect in this case was to bolster and enhance the testimony of the two state witnesses in that case, even before they testified, in this case, before the statement was played. Similarly, in Capano, the attorney, I guess, for Jerry Capano had testified that he informed the witness of the warnings and possible lie detector and consequences, and the court said that taken together, the warnings testified to by the attorney created a substantial risk that the jury would conclude that the attorney's admonitions induced Jerry to tell the truth to the federal prosecutors and hence to the jury. Implicit in the testimony that the attorney believed the admonitions were effective. That's exactly what happened in this case. So I think the main focus then is this plain error? And the answer to that question is yes. If you look to Powell versus State, it was invited error in that case where the defense attorney asked a question of the social worker who responded that 99% of the children who are involved in interfamily sexual abuse tell the truth. The court said that's plain error. In Holtzman versus State, where a 3507 statement was introduced and the police officer's personal beliefs were presented to the jury, this court said that's plain error. In this particular case, the state has said that the prosecutor...
Just so I understand the scope of your plain error argument, is it the plain error, the detail of this is how we get the definite circumstances, or you can always tell when someone's telling the truth, those type of statements are the plain error? Or are you saying all this background about RATAC is plain error? Because if that's the case, there might be a lot of it out there.
Yes. But my first argument is it was abuse of discretion, and the issue was protected by the general objection, as Sears and Wheat stated, because his basis was not cumulative. His basis, he said, this goes to bolster. Alternatively, if the court says it's plain error, everything is plain error. At the very least, the vouching that Chief Justice Steele cited to in the specific opinion is plain error. It's error, as the state's attorney has conceded. It's plain error because the prosecutor knew, apparently, that this was an incorrect answer, not what she wanted, and moved on. Yet, as the prosecutor has also stated in his previous argument, it would have been proper for her to join in a request for a limiting instruction, and she didn't. So at the very least, the prosecutor, notwithstanding anything else, was aware that this was inappropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement to recess.